Okay, we'll begin here. Looks like we're one or two short of a quorum, but we'll start anyway. We're having a presentation of state labor negotiating process and contracts. Barb Holmes, the assistant commissioner and state labor negotiator from MMB. And then after that, we'll have Mr. Hubinger, who is the director of the Legislative Coordinating Commission. So please proceed, Ms. Holmes, and please state your name for the record.
My name is Barbara Holmes. Again, I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Labor Relations over at Minnesota Management and Budget, and I also act as the state's chief labor negotiator representing management in labor negotiations with the state employee unions. My understanding is that this committee wants to know a little bit more about the labor structure and negotiations process that we go through. The first thing that certainly governs everything that we do is the state law called the Public Employees Labor Relations Act. That is a law that was passed in the 1970s. I think you're probably all aware of some major federal legislation called the National Labor Relations Act that was passed back in the mid-30s when there was a lot of labor unrest. There was also a companion state law that was passed around that time, but both of those laws applied only to the private sector. I think it was believed at that time that the labor unrest and the imbalance in power that legislation tried to address was just present in the private sector because of the profit motive that exists in the private sector, and that there weren't problems in the public sector at that time. Several decades later, in the state of Minnesota, there were some labor problems that arose in city and county-run public hospitals. There were a lot more of those sorts of institutions in the last century, and there were some labor problems and some work stoppages, and so the Minnesota legislature came in and prohibited the right to strike of those public employees, but gave them some sort of dispute resolution tools like mediation and arbitration that they had the right to use. And that was kind of the first step of giving a section of public employees some of the rights that you see more traditionally for a unionized private sector workforce. In 1959, we have the state of Wisconsin being the first state in the country to make it legal for their state employees to form and join unions and to bargain collectively. In 1962, we have President Kennedy via an executive order giving federal government public employees the right to join unions and bargain collectively. So it was kind of a matter of time before we get to the issue of Minnesota public employees, and the sort of tipping point, I think, for the legislature was a very high-profile strike by the Minneapolis teachers in 1970, and that was kind of the final impetus for the legislature to come in and say we're going to have a uniform set of policies and laws that apply to public sector employees.
Just want to interrupt for a minute. We have a quorum present, so I'll call the meeting officially to order. Excuse me, and I also looking for approval of the minutes. Anybody like to approve the minutes? Representatives Hancock, McFarland, Green. We'll just go with Representative Hancock. Moves to approve the minutes. Any discussion or corrections on the minutes? No, hearing none. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails in the minutes of January 19th are approved, and Assistant Commissioner Holmes, please proceed, and thanks for allowing me to interrupt. And I'd also want to note that if members could get here just 5 minutes early, we wouldn't have to interrupt our presenters, and we could get a quorum right away. That'd be helpful. Thanks.
And please feel free to interrupt me with any questions you have along the way. We were at 1971 when the legislature first enacted a comprehensive set of laws governing public employees' rights to join together, have unions represent them, and negotiate with the employer. This law applied and continues to apply to cities, to counties, to school districts, and to the state of Minnesota, to the University of Minnesota. The first 10 years under this law, there were some problems that developed for state government and how it worked with state government. What we ended up having is pockets of employees all over state government organizing, negotiating with their agency to the point where we ended up with 116 separate employee organizations. We had 20 different unions representing them, and we had 33 different collective bargaining agreements. And that sort of led to, quite frankly, a lot of mayhem in the labor negotiations process. There were strikes, there were lawsuits, there were arbitrations, and that prompted the legislature to come in and look at the way labor relations was working for state government. To resolve this problem of having 116 different employee groups out there, the legislature essentially created 17 separate bargaining units, and they were based on occupations. So if you look at the handout materials that you should have, there is a list of, it says executive branch represented state employees. And on and this list, when it says type of employees in the center column, these are the occupationally based bargaining units that the legislature created, and then every state employee or every state job classification is assigned to one of those bargaining units. So that got rid of the large number of employee organizations. The other thing that the legislature clarified in 1981 was that employee groups didn't go and negotiate with this agency or that agency. They could negotiate only with the state as a whole was the employer, and the legislature designated the agency, the Department of Employee Relations was designated as the lead agency to carry out those negotiations. That agency was recently merged with the Department of Finance and is Minnesota Management of Budget. The other thing that that handout shows you on the right-hand side is it denotes the unions that are, or the units that are designated essential. So I can tell you that the AFSCME units, the MAPE unit, which is professional employees, and we have a very small teachers unit, they aren't essential, and that means that they have the right to strike if we can't reach an agreement with them in contract negotiations. The rest of those bargaining units, they're deemed essential. A great example is the correction guards. The legislature made the decision we don't want them striking and what would happen if they walked off the job, so they're deemed essential. If we can't reach agreement with them on the on a contract, they have the right to take the disputed issues to an outside neutral third party, an arbitrator, and the arbitrator makes the decisions. And typically the sort of issues that are taken to an arbitrator in these situations are the wage, you know, the wage rates. There are two groups on this list that do not have the right to organize and bargain collectively with the state. That is the managers and people who are assigned to what we call the commissioner's plan. Obviously, the managers contain all the managerial employees in state government, and since they're management, they don't have the right to organize and join a union. The commissioner's plan covers mostly what we deem confidential employees, and those are employees who have access to labor relations information or they participate in the labor relations and negotiation process. So obviously we're not going to put them in a union represented sort of a situation. These employees, the managers, the confidential or commissioner plan employees, are covered by what we call plans. They're essentially personnel plans. They have a lot of similar provisions that you'll find in the labor contracts because simply they work side by side the rest of the employees who have labor union coverage. But they do not have the right to strike. State employees, if you're a state employee, if you're assigned to a certain bargaining unit, that bargaining unit is represented by a union. The unions came in right after the 1981 amendments, campaigned to represent the units, and they were selected by a majority of the members of those bargaining units to represent them. Now, people who are in that bargaining unit don't have to join the union, But they do have to pay what's called a fair share, and they're covered by the collective bargaining agreement that is negotiated. So the idea is the union goes through a lot of work to negotiate these contracts. It defends the contracts during course of negotiations, and so anybody who's covered by that agreement should have to pay their fair share for the efforts the union puts in.
Representative McFarland, you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Could you explain to me what fair share would be as far as a percentage of us of the dues, or what?
The
Assistant Commissioner Holmes.
Excuse me. Madam Chairman, Representative, the statute specifically states fair share due cannot exceed 85% of the regular dues. And my understanding is most of the fair shares are pretty close to being 85%.
Representative Holmes, maybe you could give us an idea or an estimate between these about what the actual dues are. Do you have an average? Or
I do have, of course it varies by bargaining unit what the dues are, and I have some information that sort of gives what the average dues are. I can find it here. It varies by unit, and sometimes within a particular a union will vary how much they charge an employee based on their wage rate, and then there are local union organizations that sort of piggyback, and sometimes they also charge dues, so there's sort of a variance in the dues. And I have this sheet somewhere.
Yeah, I'd like to see that. And also, could you comment a little bit on what if somebody doesn't want to be in the union? Is there a way to opt out, or?
Well, the idea
how does
is
that work?
They don't have to join the full union, but they have to pay their fair share. They are covered by the collective bargaining agreement that's negotiated, whether they want to be or not. That's the way the system is set up in this state and in a lot of states.
So they have to pay at least the 85%?
That's correct. And that's, yeah, that's correct. Maybe when Mr. Hubinger starts, I can shuffle through my papers a little bit more and give you an idea of what the union due structure is like.
Thank you. That would be helpful.
Okay. The state law says that the maximum duration of a contract that can be negotiated is 3 years, but it specifically says for teachers that the maximum duration is 2 years. I can tell you that traditionally the state has always negotiated 2-year contracts, and that is pretty much because we are on a biennial budget system. So the duration of the contracts follows the biennial budget process in that the new contracts expire, or the existing contracts expire this June 30th. Most labor laws direct the employer. What the employer and the union negotiate about is called terms and conditions of employment. It's a technical legal term. It pretty much addresses working conditions and wages and benefits. By law, this legislature has determined that pension benefits are not to be part of the negotiation process. In some states, they actually do negotiate them, but in this state, that's something outside of our process. And as you all probably know, the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement is the entity that does a very close look at pension issues and originates the legislation that eventually makes it to the full bodies. If you look at the number of employees that are in what I think most of you probably think of as the executive branch, the state agencies, but if we also include the MNSCU facilities, because that's technically part of the executive branch, there are over 50,000 employees. Of those employees, about 90% are covered by a labor contract. MMB doesn't negotiate all of the contracts for all of these employees. MNSCU has a separate labor relations function, and they negotiate three of the contracts plans for the faculty, and the administrators in their institutions. There are also what are typically you'd expect to be, and there are other employees who work for MNSCU. They're covered by the MAPE contract, the AFSCME contract, and MMB is the entity that negotiates the other nine contracts. We spend a time in the fall of the year before the contracts expire, so in the last few months, my staff spends time looking at the contracts and developing proposals for the next round of bargaining. We go to the agencies, we go to managers, we go to supervisors, and we solicit proposals or ask for information on what's working for them, what isn't, what sort of changes would they like to see. We also, on my staff, deal with labor relations issues on a day-to-day basis when we're not negotiating. So we get, of course, a feel for maybe some of the problem areas out there and generate our own proposals. Once we get to the point where we have a set of proposals that we want to go with, we need to meet with the governor because we represent essentially management. Governor is our boss and determines that sort of management priorities and strategies going into bargaining. The state has a labor has a bargaining team that's comprised of myself, some other people on the labor relations staff, compensation specialists from the state, human resource specialists. And then we draw from human resource offices across the agencies and state government to make up our bargaining team since they understand the day-to-day operations a lot better. The union, of course, has its own negotiating team made up of some professional business agents, but also primarily it's made up of employees. We usually begin negotiations in February. We meet first with the two largest employee unions, the MAPE Professional Union, a Professional Employees Union, and AFSCME. We have no negotiations with those two unions going simultaneously. We also have a unique way that we negotiate public employee insurance benefits. The unions all come together as a coalition, and we meet with that coalition and go over a lot of the background information and the various sorts of ways we could change it, a lot of the numbers and statistics about employee insurance. And they come to so that we end up in the end with insurance benefits that are the same across all of our bargaining units. So the insurance benefits that you have here at the legislature and your staff has, those are the same insurance benefits that state employees have, and they come out of our negotiations with the unions. We usually address language, what we call language proposals, changes to the various provisions in the contract first. It's a rather tedious process of presenting proposals, letting the other side recess, discuss them, come back with suggestions, questions, gathering information, modifying, making trades. We get to the end of negotiations, and that's when we actually roll out our major wage proposals and some of our benefit changes, and we at that point in time, we call it push week. It's kind of down to the crunch. It's not unlike the final week of the legislative session. There are long hours. We always bring a mediator in from the Bureau of Mediation Services. That is a state agency. They provide mediation services to the public and private sector in the state. We always bring a mediator to help us reach the final agreement. If we agree, if we reach a tentative agreement, the union then has to turn around, take that tentative agreement to their members, and their members all vote on whether to approve that agreement or reject that agreement. At that point, we bring the approved, the ratified agreement to the legislature, and Mr. Hubinger is going to explain the process, how it works for the legislative portion of the collective bargaining agreement. If we don't reach agreement with the at the table, if we don't reach agreement, again, the union, AFSCME union, the MAPE union, and the small teachers union has the right to go to a strike. The other unions, if we don't reach agreement with them, they have the right to move the process into the arbitration realm and let an outside neutral arbitrator make that final decision. The difference between mediation and arbitration, the mediator helps the parties reach a mutual agreement. In an arbitration, parties take their positions to the arbitrator, and the arbitrator makes the final agreement.
Assistant Commissioner, Representative Nelson has a question, I believe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And is that arbitration, that's binding arbitration then? Or is it non-binding arbitration?
Assistant Commissioner Holmes?
Madam Chairman, Representative, that is binding arbitration, but the legislature does have a role in final approval of that arbitration agreement, or that arbitration award. I think Mr. Hubinger will address that.
That's we have a role in stamping it, but we don't have a role in changing it, right?
I will be honest with you, there is some debate about your ability and what you can modify and not modify. I think Mr. Hubinger can address that, and also Mr. Shepherd.
Okay. Thank you. And I was actually wondering, and perhaps you haven't gotten it to it yet, the back of this, I'm wondering if one of the two of you could walk through this state employee salary settlements and maybe just talk about what those percentages mean. If you're planning on doing that, then just proceed as is, but if you'd like to address that now, that would be fine as well.
Madam Chairman, Mr. Hubinger, I believe, is going to address that in his presentation, and if you have any more questions about for me at this point in time, we can probably turn it over to him.
Anybody have any additional questions? Okay, thank you. We'll turn it over then to Mr. Hubinger, Director of the LCC. Please proceed and state your name for the record.
Good morning. Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission. First, our collective regrets for those of you who sat through this presentation yesterday. Barb and I think this is pretty fascinating stuff, but we may acknowledge that it might not be the same for you. I work for the Legislative Coordinating Commission, which is a joint House-Senate commission that's established in law. It's has 12 members, six from the House and six from the Senate, and primarily consists of the leadership from each body. So there's a dotted line here between Ms. Holmes, who works in the executive branch, and myself, who works in the legislative branch for you folks. Under the law, the Legislative Coordinating Commission is authorized to review and provide interim approval of labor contracts that have been negotiated by MMB. The LCC has not wanted to take on that responsibility, so it has established a subcommittee to take on that responsibility, and that subcommittee is known as the Legislative Subcommittee on Employee Relations. That subcommittee, in turn, has 10 members, 5 from the House and 5 from the Senate. Typically, there's a 3-2 split between the majority caucus and the minority caucus. That subcommittee has the authority to review contracts that have been negotiated. The law that governs our process is quite clear. If the subcommittee does not reject a contract within 30 days, that contract is to be implemented. So if there is a contract in front of the subcommittee and there's a motion to approve it and there's a 5-5 vote, that motion in our world fails, but the contract would be implemented anyway. Similarly, if a contract is submitted to the subcommittee and the subcommittee doesn't act on it within 30 days, again, that contract is implemented. Another caveat is that the subcommittee can only approve a contract on an up or down vote. It does not have the authority to amend them. Ms. Holmes pointed out that there are about 10% of state employees who are not represented by a union. They're unrepresented. Their terms and conditions of employment are determined through compensation plans. Ms. Holmes mentioned two of them, the managerial plan and the commissioner's plan. There are four others that are listed on the bottom of that handout that she was describing earlier. Because those plans are not negotiated but instead established by MMB or a couple of other agencies, the subcommittee does have the authority to modify those plans. There's been a fair amount of discussion this session about the frustration that members feel about what happens when the ratification bill, I should back up a step. The subcommittee does have the authority to grant interim approval of contracts and plans. Ultimately, a bill to ratify the work of the subcommittee has to pass the full legislature. And so a bill approving each of those contracts is submitted to the House and Senate and goes through the normal hearing process through the Government Operations Committee, through the State Government Finance Committee, and then Ways and Means, and then ultimately through the other body. There has been frustration by members expressed that they're only involved, most of them, at the end of the process and don't have the ability to provide input. Especially this session, there's been talk about establishing some parameters up front so that there is acceptance by the legislature at the end of the process. And Representative McNamara's bill is one example of that, where the legislature is setting a salary freeze as one parameter in the negotiations that MMB would be required to follow if that legislation became law. There are other provisions involved about this interaction between the executive branch and the legislative branch in the negotiations process. There's a provision that requires MMB to consult with the subcommittee to advise them on how the negotiations are going. There have been times when, in the course of the negotiations, the commissioner or the state labor negotiator will talk with the chair of the subcommittee and say something like, if we were to settle at X or Y, would the subcommittee be able to approve this contract? So there's that interplay interaction in the negotiations process. There have been other times, or there's a provision for the subcommittee to express the perspectives of the legislature in the negotiations process to MMB. And this is generally taking place when the negotiations are not going well, when there's increasing talk of a potential state employee strike. In those cases, members have wanted to get involved and provide their insight or their comments or the suggestions about possible settlement options. In those occasions, the subcommittee chair has sent a communication to the members of the House and Senate asking for their ideas, collating them, and then forwarding them on to the department. Just following on the chair's request, the second page of your handout is a document called the State Employees Salary Settlement Sheet. This is a tracking sheet that the subcommittee uses to track the cost of labor contracts. And this is the sheet that is being used, that has been used for the contracts that govern or that have been negotiated for this biennium, for FY10 and 11. Each of the unions is listed on the left-hand side of the page. There's some blank space in the middle of the page. This is where across-the-board increases are generally shown. What this is, this sheet is indicating is that for this current contract period, this two-year period, there were no across-the-board increases provided to any of the groups of state employees. The first column of numbers is the biennial base. This is a snapshot of the compensation paid to each of the state employee groups that was taken at the beginning of the biennium. If there had been no increases in compensation, no increases in insurance, no increases in retirement contributions, the amount that would be paid in the next biennium would be the same as this column. The next column shows the biennial new money, and this reflects all of the compensation increases that resulted from the contract negotiations or other law. Any step increases, across-the-board increases, increases in the employer share of costs of health insurance or retirement contributions by the employer are shown here. This is the cost that these agencies have to pay this year. So for the current contracts, about $39 million in additional compensation costs are being realized. I would point out that about 30% of that increased cost was for increases in costs for insurance, and about 40% was the result of increased employer contributions for retirement that was mandated by the legislature in the 2009 session, 2008. So all agencies had to absorb those costs or pay for those costs. The second to the last column on that chart shows what that percentage increase is in the current biennium. Essentially the new biennial new money divided by the biennial base. The overall impact of the compensation increases for these contracts is about 0.57%. And then the last column is perhaps the most important number for the subcommittee. It's the percentage increase biennium to biennium. There are increases that are negotiated in a contract are implemented throughout the term of the contract. An employee who gets a performance-based increase will get that midway through the year, depending on when their hire date was. And so the cost of that increase in the contract is limited to that period within the 2 years that it's being paid. but it will have to be paid all of the next 2 years. And so what we do is annualize all of those costs so that we have an accurate impact of the cost of a contract on the next biennium. And so this last number is always higher than the costs for the current biennium because we're annualizing, capturing all of the costs and their impact on the next biennium.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hubinger, you caught my attention with this sheet. First of all, just a general overall question. I notice there's no number of employees in here. There's just an aggregate payroll or payroll expense, which includes, I think, everything you described. Is it possible to know the number of employees that go with each line?
Mr. Hubinger?
That doesn't violate data practices, does it? Or
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, no, it would be quite possible to show the number of employees. The first handout that we had, the table that has the number of employees.
Thank you. And that corresponds to these lines. Madam Chair, I have one follow-on question. A couple members of this committee are also on the Legislative Audit Commission. I'm noticing the last line there. Remind me again why that number doesn't show up here. Is that handled in a different account, Mr. Hubinger?
Mr. Hubinger?
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, the that plan is the last line on the settlement sheet of that bar chart.
I see that, and there's
Representative Beard.
Oh,
and there's no numbers on that line on my sheet.
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, the auditor, like other legislative offices, had no increases negotiated, and so there were no changes to that plan.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, this is just a little platform then, just and correct me if I'm
wrong,
Representative Simon, but Legislative Audit has 60 employees listed on this side. I don't know that at the moment that it's that many, because they've had some attrition and we haven't replaced anyone over there, and I don't know if that's appropriate of anything. I just want this committee to know that in some of our commissions and work groups that we have authorized around here, there is we actually do have declining employment, and I imagine that the number that's going to go in here eventually will be a number smaller than the year before. So, thank you.
Thanks. And Representative Hornstein had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Ebinger, is there a reason that the State University Admin and Service Faculty is the only group that didn't get an increase biennium to biennium?
Mr. Hubinger.
Madam Chair and Representative Hornstein, the benefit increases for insurance and the increased contributions for insurance were paid by all of the entities, including MNSCU. The difference in the cost for both the administrative and service faculty and for the other groups in the contracts negotiated by MNSCU is that, unlike the executive branch agency staff, there were no performance-based increases at all for those faculty or administrative service staff. And so the numbers are smaller than for the other contracts.
Thank you.
Thanks. Mr. Hubinger, could you, in the chart for the last two lines, the percent increase and the percent increase biennium to biennium, I'm not sure if I understand what those two numbers are. Do they represent the percentage increase that employees actually received, and does that include health insurance benefits as well? And then what's the difference between the third column, or the second to last column, and the last column? Is that 1 year and 2 years, or how does that work?
Madam Chair, the subcommittee tracks all compensation increases, so any across the boards that were negotiated, of which there aren't any in these contracts, but there are in previous contracts, performance-based increases or step increases, employer increases in costs for retirement or for health insurance are all captured here. The second to the last column is the cost to the state of those increases in the current biennium. The last column captures the annualized impact of those increases on the next biennium. The extreme example we sometimes use to describe that for the last column is that if MMB agreed to a contract that provided a 5% increase to employees, a salary increase on the last day of a contract, there would be a tiny impact on that contract. but would have a 5% impact on the next. And so that last column captures that, all of the increases that have been agreed to and the impact on the next biennium.
Okay. I probably have a follow-up question I want to think about, but go ahead. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this last line here that was pointed out of the Office of Legislative Auditor, there's no, you said there's no increase, but don't they also share in the same health care plan as everybody else? So shouldn't there be an increase cost there for that? And also we're mandated that we put more money into the pension plans for them. I'm assuming they're in the para pension plan, so shouldn't there be cost increase in that new money in there, or is that being offset by the number of employees that have less employees working there?
Mr. Hubinger.
And Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, a good question. What we track are plans that have been submitted to the subcommittee, and because there weren't any changes to those plans, they're not reflected here. But you're absolutely right that they would be experiencing the same cost drivers as other agencies. I'd also point out, following up on Representative Beard's question, the legislative auditor has a staff of around 60. Most of those staff, 55 of them, have their terms and conditions of employment covered by the managerial or commissioner's plan. And I think there are 5 employees who are covered under this plan that's in this list here.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up a little bit on the questions that the Chair was talking about, I've had the opportunity at the local level to be involved in negotiations, and I know that sometimes we don't have all of our contracts expiring in the same year, and you may have a contract that has expired and you're still negotiating. So in the second to the last column, if I understood you correctly, you were saying that there may have been a negotiated settlement that was less because of the time period that was there, but it would be the pay increase that would be being carried forward into the next biennium. And that's why we might have some of those larger percentage shifts.
Madam Chair, Representative, as Ms. Holmes indicated quite a while ago, all of the contracts for state employees have the same begin dates and end dates duration. So, but that's not the difference between the two columns is not being driven by the difference in terms of the contract. Those are all the same. So it's what's driving the difference in the two columns is what happens when you annualize costs of increases that happen throughout the term of a two-year contract. It affects each contract differently, but gets captured in that last column.
Madam Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
So to that point, we could have contracts that may have been negotiated and agreed on before the June 30th expiration date. We may have had some that have been after that, and that's where that annualization comes in, depending upon the terms that were finally negotiated.
Mr. Hubinger.
Madam Chair, Representative, that could happen. And I think that didn't happen in this particular set of contracts, but that would be one more cost driver that would cause a difference.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Madam Chair, Representative, even if the contract is negotiated prior to the rest of them, they all start and stop on the same date, if that makes sense.
Representative O'Driscoll.
I don't mean to belabor the point, but you may have had different times in which you settled the contracts. For example, you don't have everything that's negotiated, signed, sealed, and delivered by June 30th. You may have got something by August 1st after the expiration and then be retroing back based on the terms of the contract. Or am I seeing that differently?
Ms. Holmes.
Madam Chair, Representative, no, that's correct. They usually do go back to the beginning of the contract, even if we don't have a new contract by July 1st.
Mr. Hubinger, please proceed.
Madam Chair, I think we've walked through that chart pretty well. I'd suggest we go to the last handout page, which has the a table on the top and a color graph on the bottom. This chart shows the pattern of settlements for state contracts for the last 10 years and essentially takes the numbers from the sheet that we just discussed and takes the similar sheets or parallel sheets for the previous four biennium, puts them all in one, and then displays them in chart form. The red bar on the left of each of those five biennial, five contract terms, is the cost impact of that set of contracts in that biennium. And so the contracts that were negotiated for the 2002-03 biennium had cost impacts of 6.4% that biennium. Those contracts had an impact of 9.79 on the next. In that same period, we experienced inflation as measured by CPIU of about 3.6%. And so you can see the pattern for each of these five contracts of 2 years each through this chart. I would point out, for example, that in the 2004-05 contracts that were negotiated at just as we were pulling out of the recession at the beginning of this decade, that showed an increase in cost in that contract of 1.4%. Those contracts had no across-the-board increases provided in those contracts either, but employees were eligible for step increases if they weren't at the top of their salary ranges. And then looking at the last set of contracts, the ones that we just talked about in some detail on the previous sheet, the cost impact of those contracts in this biennium was about 0.57%. And as we've indicated, employees did not receive step increases in either year. They did not receive step increases. I'm sorry, they did not receive across-the-board increases in either year. They did receive step increases in only the second year. And so the cost drivers were substantially less compared to other contract periods. Madam Chair, that's just a recent history of the settlements. And I'd also be willing to answer any questions that you have.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question, which is, let's see, on the chart that looks like this, in the second column that contains numbers, those figures include increases in insurance premiums. Is that correct?
Sure.
And I'm sorry.
Okay. Representative Green?
And I wanted to ask if this chart does as well.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Hubinger.
Yes.
Thank you.
Ms. Holmes?
Madam Chair, I'll just make one comment about that chart. And we had a bit of a discussion yesterday in the other House committee about what is the appropriate or best national index to use to compare to state employee salary increases. And this particular chart uses the CPI. There, of course, are people, the economists in my department say that there's a more appropriate index to use. The one that we use looks at labor costs, not CPI. And if you look at this particular index, it does not show as much of an increase as the CPI, so the difference between how much the state contracts have gone up and nationally what labor costs are, the disparity is less. And I'm going to be providing some information. The other committee asked for some information in that regard, and I would be glad to provide it to this committee if you're interested.
That would be wonderful. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know if you answered my question I'm going to ask already, but how do these numbers, as far as the salaries, we hear a lot of rhetoric about state employees being grossly overpaid and all that. How do these numbers compare as far as wage increases, benefit increases, to the private sector? And do you compare that when you're going through negotiations so that, you know, secretary working here compares to a secretary working on the outside, an engineer here working compares to an engineer on the outside, total package estimates. I mean, that's what we're talking here, at least in the world I come from. We talk total package, and that's what it looks like you're comparing here. So how does that compare with the private sector?
Assistant Commissioner Holmes?
Madam Chair, Representative, making comparisons of compensation between the public sector and the private sector isn't simple. You certainly have to look at the same sorts of duties or jobs or education that comprise what a state classification does and compare it to an appropriate job in the private sector. And for some state government jobs, there are not private sector comparisons. The other comment I would make is when we do lump all state employees together and come up with an average wage, our number is around 52,000. And that would place us at about 20th in the nation. Now, that's just wages. When you look at making comparisons about total compensation, the biggest chunk, two biggest chunks you're adding in are what's the value of the insurance package and what's the value of the retirement contribution or the retirement package. And getting accurate costs of what the insurance, what the value of an insurance package is in the private sector is difficult. And insurance packages differ so much in the various components of what may be covered, and valuing the differences between those is complicated. Not that people don't do it and not that it isn't done, but it's not as simple as taking a flat average. So I can tell you that in general, when you look at the what are typically the higher paid employees in state government, that when you make those comparisons to the private sector, they're underpaid. When you look at the lower paid jobs, we're looking more comparable. And some will argue that we pay more. There are so many studies out there, and so many of the studies use different groups, and so many of the studies are, I don't think they're completely without some sort of political implications that they go into, so it's a very complicated issue. In terms of your question about how much do we look at the market in setting state employees' salaries, there is a statute that was enacted by the legislature that says what directs us what to look at when we're addressing making compensation decisions. There are six different factors. One of those factors is the market. There are other things that are equally as important. We need to look how we need to look at the group as a whole. There has to be some sort of equity between what we pay all employees. And the problem with the market is you're going to go through a period of time where a certain type of employee is making a heck of a lot more out there. And so if you increase just that particular group in state employees, of state employees, you're going to have some internal inequities there. The other complicating factor is that we are covered by collective bargaining agreements, and those limit our ability to address some of these market concerns. But the unions have worked with us in the past, most recently probably about 10 years ago. It was very difficult for us to get information technology employees because the private sector was paying incredible amounts for that, and we were able to work with them to make some adjustments in the rates for those type of employees.
Thank you.
Do you have a follow-up question or no? I actually have a follow-up question on that. You mentioned, I think, that was it compared to other states that we're ranked about 20th in the nation for salaries? Is that what you were saying?
Yes.
So my question is, I think you said that just includes wages, and that's quite a bit different than some of the numbers that I've seen, and I know there's different studies, as you mentioned. Do you have any idea what that ranking would be if you included all the other retirement and health benefits? And also, I was just curious if you happen to know what the study was called, or if I could get a copy of that, perhaps.
You may be aware of a study that recently came out that was sponsored by the Minnesota Chamber.
Yes, I think that's where I saw different numbers.
And the number that they used in there as the average salary for state employees was higher than that, but they only looked at a select group of state employees. They didn't look, for the purposes that they were making comparisons of, they didn't look at all of them. So if you look at all of them and look at what the average is, it ranks at 20th in there.
Is it 20th just wages, though? Do you have a number for wages with the other benefits as well?
I don't. I've seen numbers. They vary greatly, but I can pull together a number of the major ones and certainly get them to you if you'd like to see that information.
Yeah, it'd be helpful just to have it, and if you had the source on who did the study or whatever, that would be helpful too. Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll?
It seems like you and I are playing bingo. You have half the questions and I have the other half on the same topic.
Probably
here, Madam
you
Chair.
Just probably have a better way of saying it.
I doubt that, because that's why you're the chair. The
I'm the chair because I've been here longer.
To the question of, and I don't want to use the term cherry picking specifically for the chamber report, but why some areas were excluded, the private sector wouldn't be able to hire law enforcement, correctional employees, and those types of things. So wouldn't it make sense that they would be factored out when the private sector is looking to compete with IT people, as you've indicated, because they would be people who would make a choice of going to the public sector or the private sector, where the occupations that I mentioned before would really only have one track, and that would be in the public sector.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, I agree that there again was a reason for them finding comparable jobs, that whole issue I was talking about before. But the thing with that study is the slice that they ended up with state government was a very small slice in terms of, I think it covered, 9,000 employees? And I don't know if that's, if you want to compare averages and you want to compare them nationally and you want to compare them across states, then we would have to look at that same precise number across states. So it's complex. It's tricky. And we try and look at that data and try and ask those sorts of questions in the same questions you're asking.
Just thank you. I'm new to the committee, and I'm just trying to collect some background and information. So thank you.
Other questions? Anybody else have questions? Representative Winkler, see you.
Madam Chair, I'm just curious. I mean, I think it's a valid thing to compare, to make sure that your salaries and benefits are comparable, and to know what that comparison is between the public and private sector. But, I mean, do you have any thoughts on what kind of comparisons should be made? I mean, we do have to hire prison guards. So, you know, it seems to me that there's an equal argument for factoring that into a study and factoring out of a study. Government is not the same thing as the private sector. You don't want to be out of line, but you want to somehow have a comparison that gives some information about where you are against the market. Is there kind of an ideal way of doing that comparison?
Ms. Holmes?
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, I don't know if there's an ideal way. I rather doubt it. I think it becomes a little bit of an art. I think we always, I know that if state contracts aren't approved and they go to an outside neutral arbitrator, that arbitrator still looks at all the different factors. They're required by law to look at internal comparisons. And certainly when they start looking at what should a prison guard make? I mean, what we're looking at is other public jurisdictions to what a prison guard makes. So they're not directly comparable. We provide different services. They're not directly comparable. But it affects us in terms of our ability to attract and retain. So it's one factor we have to look at of many.
No other questions? Did you have more in your presentation, Mr. Hubinger?
I'm sorry.
Are we wrapped up then? Okay, well, adjourn the meeting, and we will see you tomorrow.